KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, we'll be talking with one of America's leading radicals, linguists, and intellectuals. Noam Chomsky has a new book. It's called Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy, and he joins us right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. The New York Times called Noam Chomsky arguably the most important intellectual, and the Boston Globe has referred to him as America's most useful citizen. Certainly, intellect and radical activist citizenship have been hallmarks and touchstones to a career in the public eye of one of the world's foremost linguistic experts, the creator of generative grammar and longtime MIT professor, now emeritus, of linguistics and philosophy. In addition to his pioneering work in linguistics, Noam Chomsky is the author of numerous best-selling political works, including America and the New Mandarins, Hegemony or Survival, and Imperial Ambitions. His newest book is called Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy. And he joins us for this morning's second hour forum from Wellesley, Massachusetts, and a phone line that we hope is going to hold. Noam, good to have you back after all these years. Welcome.
Yeah, very good to be here.
I guess I'd like to start where you start. You start with Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein in your new book, and you get into something that, as you say, isn't probably talked about enough, and that is the nuclear threat, by quoting those two and their concern about keeping the planet and making sure that aggression and all the sort of things that lead to volatility don't happen as much as we can stave them off. What I'm wondering is, especially since you mentioned people like Graham Allison, is the increased nuclear threat, and you mentioned, for example, militarization of space, is the increased nuclear threat because of the United States, as you seem to imply, largely and even more so than it is with North Korea, Iran, or bin Laden?
Well, yeah, in terms of scale, there's just no question. The U.S. is, and this, I think, is just a consensus among strategic analysts and is more or less obvious from looking at it. The U.S. is far in the lead in escalating the serious threat of nuclear war. I mean, you can just take a look at the quotes I give and the sources I cite, which are from right in the mainstream. There's a serious threat from North Korea, from Iran, and conceivably from Al-Qaeda. But in large measure, we're responsible for escalating those threats. For example, why would, say, take Iran, which is, in the case of Al-Qaeda, the major threat is that they will somehow obtain, conceivably a missile, but possibly material that can be used for nuclear weapons. Where are they going to get them? Well, one of the places they might get them, and may have them, in fact, is from the invasion of Iraq. It's discussed there.
You talk about the looting in your book, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there were means to develop weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It was known. They were under supervision of U.N. inspectors and being dismantled. When Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz sent their troops in, the inspectors were kicked out. They didn't bother safeguarding them. And they were systematically looted, systematically. U.N. Analysts continued to inspect.
So forgive me, there were WMDs, as you point out.
Yes, they were there. They were being dismantled. Also means to develop them, like precision high-tech precision equipment that could be used for developing nuclear weapons. They were systematically looted, not by individuals. And we can only imagine and fear where that went to. But nevertheless, that's a pretty remote threat.
Wouldn't it be as likely, excuse me, that they could go to the former Soviet Union or Pakistan, though?
Well, Pakistan is most likely. That's been the center of the Soviet Union doesn't want to. But Pakistan has been the center of the major smuggling operations for years. And where did the Pakistani nuclear weapons come from? Well, the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration pretended year after year, I stress pretended, that Pakistan was not developing nuclear weapons. They knew it was. It was, in fact. And one of their leading nuclear weapons developers became the center of a major distribution network, sending parts and material for nuclear weapons all over the place. Take, say, North Korea. I mean, there was an agreement. One of the good things that Clinton did was a framework agreement, which in which North Korea was to stop its nuclear weapons-related activity, as apparently it did, as far as anyone knows, in return to for actions by the United States, like water reactor or other things. Neither side totally lived up to its obligations, the U.S. included. But when Bush came in, he just abandoned it all. Said, no, we're not going to do this. Okay. They went back to developing nuclear weapons, as everyone predicted. Can it be dealt with? Yeah, in similar ways. Iran is a more striking case. Iran, as far as anyone knows, is operating within the framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. I mean, they may have something secret going on, and there's reasons for suspicions about that, but it's unknown. However, Iran has repeatedly offered to negotiate all of these issues. In 2003, for example, Iran, this is under the moderate Khatami government, but with the support of the hardline clerics, they offered to negotiate all outstanding issues, including nuclear issues, including a two-state settlement for the Arab-Israel-Palestine conflict, everything. The Bush administration didn't respond. It just censured the Swiss diplomat who had brought the offer. Well, those offers have been repeated, including the two-state settlement, and they're just ignored. That's a good way of accelerating a conflict. Iran did make an arrangement, a deal with the European Union in which 2004, in which they agreed to suspend their legal, perfectly legal uranium enrichment programs. They said they'd suspend them, and in return, the European Union was to provide, phrasing was, firm guarantees on security issues. Well, we all know what that means. Security issues refer to the U.S.-Israeli threats to attack Iran. Now, those threats themselves are serious violations of international law, and Iran rightly wants some kind of guarantee that it won't be attacked. Well, the Bush administration refuses. The European Union couldn't live up to its side of the bargain. So finally, Iran dropped the bargain, too, and returned to enriching uranium. The way that's described in the West, mostly here almost universally, is that Iran broke the agreement. But that's, you know, it's not exactly the story. Well, they say they're willing to go back to it. Last January, they again made a similar offer. They're willing to negotiate now. The U.S. has slightly shifted its position. And this is described in the press as a great shift towards moderation and negotiation. But take a look at it. The U.S. has agreed to negotiate, but it is unwilling to withdraw the threats. So it's willing to negotiate at the point of a gun. That's not a negotiation. Furthermore, it's willing to negotiate on the condition that Iran agrees in advance to the desired outcome, namely permanent suspension of uranium enrichment. Well, you know, that's maybe you can sell that in the press, but that's not a serious offer.
What about the narrative we're getting in the press here, though, that Iran essentially not only wants to destroy Israel, its prime minister has said that the Zionist entity should be annihilated, or words that have been at least from Farsi perhaps interpreted to mean that, and they have certainly armed Hezbollah for that purpose?
The West, the U.S. in particular, loves the ravings of Ahmadinejad, and they're very widely publicized. But he has a superior the what's called the, what they call the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, who's the who's in charge, and probably in a reprimand to Ahmadinejad, he repeated last June, I think it was, the he repeated the Iranian proposal to accept a two-state settlement to the Arab to the Palestine-Israel conflict. The way he put it was that Iran accepts the position of the Arab League on this issue. Well, the position of the Arab League is the 2002 Arab League agreement to a Saudi plan. Palestinians also agreed. The plan was for full normalization of relations with Israel if it accepts the international consensus on a two-state settlement. Well, that's Iran. That's the superior to Ahmadinejad. I don't think that was published anywhere, but it's a far more important, I mean, in the mainstream at least, but it's a far more important statement than Ahmadinejad's, and it's been reaffirmed. So you can read in the London Financial Times that it was reaffirmed by an Iranian diplomat a couple of weeks ago. Well, the West doesn't want to hear that. What about arming Hezbollah? Hezbollah is regarded in Lebanon. It's in Lebanon. It's just called the resistance. Take a look at this morning's newspapers. They conceded by now. It's the resistance. Do they want to destroy Israel? Well, Hezbollah's leader, Nasrallah, has said explicitly that he doesn't regard Israel as a legitimate state, and Hezbollah won't accept it. But if the Palestinians accept a two-state settlement, that's he'll go along. They won't disrupt it. He says it's a Palestinian issue. Whatever the Palestinians accept, they will accept. They're a Lebanese organization, and they deeply integrated into Lebanon. They want to solve the problems of Lebanon in the way that they prefer.
Talking with Noam Chomsky, his new book is called Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy. The thesis of your book, Noam Chomsky, seems to be that the U.S. is a terrorist state under its own definition, and it doesn't comply with the universal law, in other words, following the principles that it expects out of other nations. You also call it a failed state because of something you describe as democratic deficit, that public opinion is not reflected by public policy. It goes back, I think, in many ways, does it not, to some of your earlier work where you say public policy is shaped by media, but nevertheless people sort of in some ways really come above that?
Yeah, I and plenty of others have been writing about this for a long time, but it is reaching pretty extreme levels. In this book, in fact, I run through some of the recent the kind of public opinion studies that were taken right before and right after the 2004 election, and they're pretty striking. They show a dramatic gap between public policy and public opinion. That's one of the reasons why the party managers made it were very careful to ensure that issues would basically be off the agenda in the 2004 election. It would be restricted to what the PR industry calls qualities or personality or something like that. And most of the public just remained totally unaware of the positions of candidates on issues. So take, say, the Kyoto Protocol as an example. As you know, the government, and including the near-unanimous Senate, Democrats, too, rejected it. The Bush administration said it's all gone, it's finished forever, we're not going to have anything to do with it. The public supports it so strongly that a majority of Bush voters assumed that he supported it. That's only one example. I'll give a long list there, just quoting the public opinion studies. What's happened is that, roughly speaking, both political parties are pretty far to the right of the general population on a host of serious issues. And these figures are particularly striking because public opinion is constructed almost person by person. The people are not repeating what they read or what they hear because they don't hear it and they don't read it.
But what we read is of red states and of evangelicals who take conservative positions and support the president's policies and all that.
many of them, not all, of course, but a majority of the evangelicals do, and they have been mobilized as a political force, but that's not the majority of the population. If you take a look at popular attitudes on on international affairs, on international crises, who should take the lead on the so-called war on terrorism, on domestic issues like health care, on and on, it's just radically different. I mean, one of the most striking examples was the major study of public opinion right after the federal budget was announced in February 2005, first federal budget of the second Bush administration. There was a major study by the Program on International Policy Attitudes, the most respected polling institution. Public attitudes were almost the opposite of the budget, where the budget was going up. The public wanted them to go down by large majorities. Military spending, supplementals for Iraq and Afghanistan, and so on. Where spending was going down, the public wanted to go up, also by very large majorities. Health, education, welfare, renewable energy, support for the United Nations, just right through a long list. Actually, I quote the results there. Well, those another useful comment about this is that the results were apparently not reported. A friend of mine who does database searches checked carefully and couldn't find a single report in any American newspaper of very dramatic information. Information that says the public is completely opposed, radically opposed, to the federal budget, meaning public policy. And the same has been true on occasion after occasion. That's a serious problem inside the United States.
Talking with Noam Chomsky again, his new book is Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy. You mentioned Michael Scheuer, who's been on this program, leading U.S. Terrorist specialist, and talk about his view, which is, I think, pretty much your view, that once again, the policies of the invasion of Iraq, and which you pretty much linked to oil, but have increased the threat of terror. Of course, President Bush has said publicly it's better to fight the foreign forces and the terrorists on their own turf, meaning Iraq, presumably. But as you point out in the book, you've got about 5 to maybe 10% only of forces from outside of Iraq.
Not only that, but I also point out there, quoting Anthony Kordesman and other terrorism specialists, that according to Israeli and Saudi intelligence, who are the most informed, that 5 to 10% are almost entirely people who had no earlier records. They were mobilized by the attack on Iraq. I quote other terrorism specialists, who actually I think there's a near consensus on this, who point out that the Bush is now fighting terrorists in Iraq, but he created them. They weren't there before.
It's an incubator for training terrorists, is what you're saying.
It's an incubator for training terrorists. That's the CIA's conclusion. Actually, it was the warning as well. The same intelligence agencies and terrorism specialists who are now reporting and lamenting the sharp increase in terror caused by the war in Iraq, before the war, they were warning of the same thing. And we didn't need them to figure it out. It's obvious that it's going to happen. In some way, the same is going to happen, almost surely, is going to be the result of the U.S.-Israeli invasion of Lebanon. It's creating new generations of radical Islamist jihadists.
You bring a lot of history to bear in the book, some of it fascinating. I mean, early on when you talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis and how close, even by a word, we came to actually a nuclear threat, but also later on talking about the invasion of Iraq and the historical precedent going back to Jackson, that is President Jackson, Andrew Jackson, and John Quincy Adams, the Secretary of State. This is fascinating.
Well, actually, the reason I bring that up is because there's one major scholarly book by John Lewis Gaddis, a well-known, respected Yale historian, the book is about the roots of the Bush Doctrine, which he approves of. I mean, criticizes tactics, but basically approves of. So that's the major scholarly book on the roots of the Bush Doctrine. He starts with Andrew Jackson and the Seminole Wars and John Quincy Adams. And what I did in reviewing it is just point out the facts which he ignores from his own sources. I mean, using his own sources, the right scholarly sources, I just report what they in fact say. It's almost the opposite of his conclusions. And in fact, what they say is correct. And that probably is the roots of the Bush doctrine, and it's shocking and dangerous.
The idea that a war could be fought without congressional approval.
Not partly that. And Adams, in fact, recognized with regret later in his life that this had established the precedent of wars fought in violation of the Constitution, executive wars. But much more serious than that is the principle which Gaddis actually recognizes and emphasizes. He said the Adams-Jackson War, which was the conquest of Florida and the destruction of the Seminoles, what they called the lawless Indians and the runaway slaves, the principle behind it, as he says, was that expansion is the path to security. So if you want security, you have to expand. Well, that is a doctrine, and that is the Bush doctrine, except now it's expand the whole world and, in fact, to space. Sure, if you want total security, you're going to have to rule everything. And what you're going to do by ruling everything is create insecurity, like, for example, increasing the threat of terror and of nuclear proliferation.
What do you say to the kind of criticism you get, which has been strong through the years, that you essentially take too anti-American a line and that you're much too harsh, especially for a Jewish American, on Israel?
Well, first of all, the idea that I take an anti-American line is a very intriguing one. It's a standard concept in totalitarian states. If you identify state power with the culture, the society, the population, and so on, if you make that identification, strict totalitarian doctrine, then a person who criticizes state policy is anti-American. In the Soviet Union, they used to call them anti-Soviet. So the dissidents were anti-Soviet. They weren't against Russia, you know, or against Russian culture or Russian people, but they were against state policy. So it's a striking totalitarian concept. It's an interesting fact about the United States that it's used freely here, but almost in no democratic society. I mean, take, say, Italy. If somebody criticizes Berlusconi's policies, then nobody would call them anti-Italian.
So it's hegemony, really, that brings that out. Yeah.
It's a criticism of policy.
Yeah.
And if you want to know the history, every Israeli knows, because they know the Bible, the origins of the concept anti-Israel. It goes back to the Bible. It goes back to King Ahab, who was the epitome of evil in the Bible. He condemned the prophet Elijah for being what he called in Hebrew a hater of Israel. Was he a hater of the Jews? No, he condemned the acts of the evil king. That made him a hater of Israel. Well, you know, that's the origins of this concept, this totalitarian concept.
Let me ask you to hold that thought because we're coming up on a break, and I want to invite our listeners to join us. In fact, you're cordially invited to participate in this live program. Our guest, Noam Chomsky, your calls are welcome. Toll free, 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, join us at that number. It's toll free, 866-733-6786. Or if you'd like to join us with questions or comments by email, you can do that as well. Our email address is forum, F-O-R-U-M, at kqed.org. Talking with Professor Noam Chomsky, and his new book again is Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Noam Chomsky, whose new book is called Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy. He's with us from Wellesley, Massachusetts, and we're going to go to your calls here forthwith. I just wanted to follow through on something brought up before we went to the break. I guess, Professor Chomsky, the criticism has been not only perhaps too harsh on Israel, which I think you just answered quite well, but that you have perhaps also maybe not been critical enough, in fact, I've seen this in print a couple of times, of the treatment of the Palestinians by the Arab states.
Yeah, I've been quite critical about that, but yes, it's true. I don't concentrate on that. There's a very simple reason for it. You and I happen to share responsibility for what the U.S. and Israel are doing to the Palestinians. We have only the most indirect responsibility for what the Arab states are doing. The Arab states hate them. I've pointed that out over and over and have undermined them at every point. But we have responsibility for what we do and what we can influence. I mean, we could indirectly influence the Arab states. So our closest ally and oldest ally and most valued ally in the Middle East is Saudi Arabia, for the oil is the most extreme fundamentalist government in the world. It makes Iran look like a flourishing democracy. So yes, we have a certain amount of influence on Saudi Arabia, and we could, for example, we could influence Saudi Arabia. So, for example, let's take a current case: the Arab League in the invasion of Lebanon, the Arab League, in defiance of public opinion, it was pointed out, the Arab League leaders, the tyrants who run the states, took a mildly pro-Israeli stance, and an stance that's harmful to the Palestinians. Well, we could have influenced them to do the opposite, except that that's what the U.S. government wanted. In fact, they had to back down under pressure from their own populations. As for Lebanon, you know, where I was last May, you know, I think that, as I spoke there, don't have to talk about it here, they should be offered decent lives and existence in Lebanon instead of being confined in miserable refugee camps. Okay, that's a serious problem for Lebanese to deal with. It doesn't make much sense for me to criticize it. I mean, I do when I'm there, but not here rarely. The overwhelming issue, both in scale and because it's our responsibility and we can do something about it, is U.S.-Israeli policy. So sure, we ought to concentrate on that. I mean, we understand that principle very well with regard to official enemies. So let's take, say, Soviet dissidents. I mean, do we care what they said about the United States or, you know, the Congo or anyone else? We cared about what they said about the Soviet Union. Or take Iranian dissidents today. Do we care whether they condemn the Israeli invasion of Lebanon? No. We care what they're saying about Iran. And that same principle applies to us, even more so because we have privilege and live in a very free society, so we can do lots of things that they can't do.
Again, we're talking with Noam Chomsky. We'll try to get as many of you on here with us as we can. We begin, Ken, with you. Good morning. Welcome to the forum.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I really, Noam Chomsky, you're one of my biggest heroes. I rent all your DVDs, and I watch them carefully, and they just make me feel so well-informed and in the world. And I just have a question for you about Iraq and the beginning of the war. I have this theory that the sanctions were about to come off Iraq, and Iraq had already had these signed contracts with France, Germany, China, et cetera, to sell their oil to those countries. And American oil companies and George Bush couldn't let that happen, so they invaded. They annulled those contracts and signed a contract with only American companies. And I feel like that was their justification for the war. Now, I was just wondering what you thought about that. And I can hang up and listen.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for the call.
Well, first, thanks for the kind comments. We don't – nobody knows the answer to that question. We don't have information about the internal discussions and debates going on within the executive branch. And there's a more general point that we should bear in mind. Why are all these things kept secret? Why is there a classified record? Well, if you run through the declassified record in the United States or anywhere else that I know about, you discover that the issues are not security, except security of the government from its own population. They essentially want to keep the population in ignorance of what they're doing, and usually for good reasons. Those we mentioned earlier, the public is usually opposed. So we don't know what their internal thinking was. What you describe may very well have been a factor. My judgment, and it's just an assessment, yours is as good as mine, but my assessment is it was not a major factor. The major factor, I think, was to ensure that the U.S. government maintains control over the vast energy resources of the Middle East. I stress control, not access. Policies would be the same if we were on solar energy. In fact, they were the same when the U.S. didn't use a drop of Middle East oil. The point is control for reasons that were clearly expressed 60 years ago, namely that this is what the State Department called a stupendous source of strategic power, the most strategically important area in the world. If you control the energy resources, you have a lever of control over the whole world. So that's extremely important. The U.S. had to withdraw its forces, military forces, from Saudi Arabia. The Pentagon recognized this, Wolfowitz talked about it, because it was just stirring up enormous popular anger. In fact, it's one of the main sources of Al-Qaeda. So they wanted to withdraw them from Saudi Arabia. They have to place them somewhere else. They do have them in the Emirates, but there couldn't be a better place than Iraq. For one thing, Iraq has the, as far as is known, the second largest energy resources in the world. Also, they're very cheap and accessible. You don't have to dig through tar sands and stuff. And it's right at the heart of the energy-producing region. If they could install a client state in Iraq, which would do their bidding, kind of like, you know, El Salvador, Guatemala, and so on, if they could install a client state and place their military bases there, they would be in an extremely important, powerful position. Zbigniew Brzezinski is one of the more astute of the small planning circles, happened to be critical of the war, but he pointed out that if the U.S. succeeds in Iraq, it will have what he called critical leverage over its industrial rivals, Asian and European. Critical leverage comes from having your hand on the spigot. That's been a guiding policy for 60 years. So my guess is that's the main, that was the main driving force.
You mentioned the troops in Saudi Arabia, and in your book you talk about troops in Muslim lands pretty much being at the top of bin Laden's concerns or caveats to the West.
Particularly Saudi Arabia, because that's the most holy land.
Right, Medina and Mecca there. But you also mentioned predatory capitalism, and I found myself wondering, is it your sense that if we would take troops out of all Muslim lands and perhaps be less predatory in our, we being the United States, that there would still not be the desire by bin Laden and his minions to establish some kind of caliphate over the world as we have been reading about?
Well, they don't actually call for a caliphate over the world. I mean, they're crazy enough, but not that. What they call for is for a caliphate over Muslim lands. They have never indicated any desire to establish a caliphate in Western Europe, which would be ludicrous. In fact, you can see what happened in Russia and Afghanistan. I mean, as long as the Russians were invading Afghanistan, as Russian troops were there, they were organized by the U.S. In fact, they were the jihadis were fighting the Russians. In fact, they even carried out terrorism within Russia during those years. As soon as Russia withdrew, that was the end of jihadi terrorism against Russia from Afghanistan. End, no more. It did continue, but from Chechnya, which is also an occupied Muslim land. And they've been pretty consistent about this. I suspect that Michael Scheuer might have said this if you asked him. I think that people who followed Al-Qaeda closely understand and agree that they're actions are pretty much consistent with their words.
He did say that, but he also seemed to feel that there was enough enmity against the West that they and against what we could call the Judeo-Christian world that they would like to see.
They would like to what? I'm sorry.
They would like to see essentially an annihilation of as they saw on 9/11 of many of those who are not of their faith or their belief.
Yeah, well, not the 9/11 case is interesting. First of all, the background of it, as again he's written and others have written like him, is the initial what turned Osama bin Laden against the United States was in 1990. He wanted to lead a jihad against Iraq when it invaded Kuwait, and the Saudi military, backed by the United States, refused. Then they invited American troops, which to him or any, you know, religious, ultra-religious Muslim is the utter indignity and total violation of Quranic principles and so on, inviting infidel troops to the holiest country. Well, at that point, he turned against the United States. The first attack on the World Trade Center, remember, was 1993, shortly after that, probably not Osama bin Laden, but Egyptian-based jihadis. And so it continues. From their point of view, as Scheuer has written, it's a defensive war. You can hate it or like it, but they perceive themselves as fighting a defensive war, the invasion of Muslim lands. Now, it's also worth bearing in mind that the jihadi groups and organizations, even the most militant of them, were quite angry about 9/11 and bitterly opposed to it. There's very good studies of this by Fawaz Gerges, who's the main American scholar on these topics and has studied the jihadis very closely. He reviews the facts and cites, you know, angry fatwas by leading radical clerics denouncing Osama bin Laden for carrying out the 9/11 attack, which they were opposed to. They regarded it as adventurous and immoral and in violation of Islamic principles and so on. Well, okay, at that point, Bush decided to, his handlers decided to invade Afghanistan. Okay, here's the U.S. again attacking a Muslim land. So that changed all that. The same clerics who had...
A Muslim land that was essentially giving sanctuary, of course, to Osama bin Laden.
Well, it was, and there might very well have been a diplomatic solution for that. Recall that the war was not undertaken to overthrow the Taliban. That was not a war. That came 3 weeks later, after the bombing. The war was undertaken with the official aim, demand, that the Taliban hand over Osama bin Laden and his colleagues. Well, the Taliban took an ambiguous attitude toward that. They asked for evidence. And notice that Bush didn't call for extradition. That would require evidence. He just said, hand them over. The Taliban said, give us some evidence. And they made various other proposals, which may have been serious or may not. We don't know because the Bush administration rejected them, insisted that he hand them over, even though they had no evidence. In fact, they conceded that they had no evidence. 8 months later, the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, gave a long interview in the Washington Post, his first discussion of this, in which he said 8 months later, we suspect that the 9/11 plot was hatched in Afghanistan, but implemented in Germany and the United Arab Emirates. Well, if that's what they suspected 8 months later, they didn't know it in October, so they couldn't hand over evidence because they didn't have it. Could that have been pursued? Well, again, we don't know because it wasn't tried. They insisted on bombing the Afghans until they follow U.S. orders. In fact, that became explicit by the end of the month, by the end of October. They announced to the Afghan people, we'll continue to bomb you unless you throw out the Taliban government. Well, you know, that's pure terrorism. Of course, Muslims all over the world bitterly opposed it, as did many others, incidentally. The idea that there was widespread support for this is just a myth. You can read the Gallup polls in late September when they were talking about the bombing. There was overwhelming opposition to it throughout the world, particularly in Latin America, where, like in Mexico, I think there was 2% support. These are the countries that have had some experience with...
But not in the United States.
United States was different, and England was somewhat different. But the only two countries in an international Gallup poll that gave support to the impending bombing, the only two were India, outside the U.S. and Britain, the only two were India and Israel. But India and Israel had no interest whatsoever in Afghanistan. India was thinking about Kashmir, and Israel was thinking about the Palestinians.
We've got more callers in here, and Mick, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the show. And Dr. Chomsky, thank you for being a continuous voice of reason and insanity in a time that's really neither, in my opinion. I think it'd be interesting to note as well, let's not forget, wasn't there a Taliban delegation that came to Texas in the mid-90s to negotiate a pipeline with UNICAL? So there was some friendship there at one point. But my real question was, in what I perceive as well as an age of sort of neo-totalitarianism in this country and blanket ignorance with a good percentage of the population, my main issue has been the elections. I believe we've had two coups d'etat. And the statistics bear that out for any rational, free-thinking person. If I could, I'd just say Dr. Stephen Freeman from the University of Pennsylvania has written great analyses, statistical analyses, raw election data, et cetera. And I'm wondering if my premise is correct, that the elections essentially are so rigged with all these electronic voting machines, et cetera, and they've actually been stolen twice in terms of presidential, not to mention others. How does a population that's basically, for the most part, ignorant of what's going on, counter this massive fraudulent hijacking of our electoral system? You can't throw them out of office. What do you do? Thanks very much.
Thank you for the call. Noam Chomsky.
I don't disagree. I mean, I think you can certainly make a case that the elections were won by fraud. But if you want my personal opinion, that's a minor issue. I mean, the elections are the electoral vote, both in 2000 and 2004, was pretty close to 50-50. I mean, maybe there's some chicanery and juggling and so on, but it was kind of like tossing a coin. The real issue, the fundamental issue about the elections, in my opinion, is that they didn't take place in the first place. You don't have elections when the two political parties are unwilling to allow issues to be discussed by the population. And when the elections are run openly by the public relations industry, which sells candidates the same way they sell toothpaste on television. Now, when you look at a television ad, say a car ad, you don't expect to learn anything from it. I mean, if we had a market system, anything like it, General Motors would put up a notice saying, here are the car models we want to sell next year, here are their characteristics. They don't do that. They put up a football player or an actress or a car carrying out some miraculous action or something, and they try to delude you with imagery, not tell you about not give you information. I mean, we all know this. We know that it's all delusion and imagery. Well, when they sell candidates, they do the same thing. So they create imagery of Bush and imagery of Kerry. They keep away from the issues. The population doesn't know the stands of the candidates on issues, and we look at the...
You see the debates as useless, futile?
The debates are almost useless. They're just, first of all, they're highly programmed. And the candidates will not discuss the issues. I mean, just to take one example, take the last debate, October 28th, I think it was. It was focused on domestic issues. Well, for the American population, the most significant domestic issue, or very high or highest for a long time, has been the collapsing healthcare system. I mean, it's the worst in the industrial world by a long shot, and people suffer from it. And for a long time, a large majority of the population has wanted some kind of national health care system. That's been shown in poll after poll. Okay, here we come to a debate on domestic issues. And actually, the New York Times the next day accurately described what happened. It praised it, but described it accurately. It said that Kerry refused to mention any kind of government role in health care because it has so little political support. The only support it has is an overwhelming majority of the population. But from the standpoint of the political managers and the liberal press, like the New York Times, that's not political support. Political support means support from the pharmaceutical corporations and the insurance, the financial institutions, and so on. That's true. They don't support it. So therefore, it has no political support, and Kerry didn't mention it. Well, what about the population? They're just not part of the system. I mean, and that generalizes in case after case after case.
It's because of lobbying, isn't it, really?
You don't have elections.
I mean, it's because of pressure groups and lobbying. And the money. It's because of pressure groups and lobbying, and they're not only representing what goes on in government, but also donating large amounts to the campaigns.
You know, I mean, there's a very narrow concentration of economic power in the country. We all know that. And that overwhelmingly dominates the electoral system. In fact, the upcoming elections, 2006, the whole House of Representatives is coming up for election. Well, you go back to the founding fathers, say Madison. The conception was the House of Representatives would be the Democratic part of the government, people would actually, their opinions would actually be represented there. But the Senate, which, as Madison put it, is restricted to the wealth of the nation, the most responsible group of men, those who have sympathy with property and so on, the Senate would be the dominant force, and the population would be kind of removed from, mostly from picking senators. But the House is supposed to be the Democratic force. Take a look at the next election that's coming up. Count the number of House seats that are even contested. I don't remember the exact percentage, but it's a small percentage. Count the number of incumbents who are defeated. I mean, it has become the least democratic component of government because it's all bought.
It's also certainly attributable, is it not, to gerrymandering and to
gerrymandering
just the power of incumbency? I mean, it's our whole system.
Yeah, I mean, gerrymandering is a striking case. In the last election, 2004, the reason the Republicans did not decline in House membership was because of the radical gerrymandering in Texas, which set up a situation in which Democrats can't win.
Let me get you on here. Chuck, good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. Thanks very much. You mentioned the militarization of space. I'd be interested if you had any specific information about weapon systems or the role of NASA in that. And what do you think we should do in Iraq? If we withdraw the populations caught in the middle of a civil war, if we train up an Iraqi military in the absence of a democratic government, it seems like it's just going to be our proxies fighting other proxies. Or we could establish a real democratic government and give them a peaceful way to resolve their differences, but that's kind of what we say we're trying to do now. So I'd be real interested to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Chuck.
On militarization of space, since time's brief, I would just suggest that you take a look at the sources that are cited in the book of mine that just came out, which basically says everything that I know about it, you know, runs through the specialist literature, and it's about what I can say. On Iraq, the United States definitely does not want a democratic government in Iraq. I mean, that's almost certain. The idea of, if just think for a minute, what the, I mean, it's amazing that this isn't discussed. There's an enormous discussion about withdrawal, you know, exit strategies and so on, but they almost never mention the crucial issue. The crucial issue is that a sovereign Iraq, which is moderately democratic, would be a nightmare for U.S. planners. I mean, a sovereign democratic Iraq would have a Shiite majority. If it was mildly democratic, they'd be the major force. The Iraqi Shiites have pretty close relations to Iran. One of the main militias in the south, Bada Brigade, was trained in Iran. The clerics, who are very influential, have very close relations with Iran. The Ayatollah Sistani, the major one, was born in Iran. They still have Iranian citizenship.
This has come up on the show, excuse me, and some experts have said yes, but they have a distinct Iraqi identity and they don't necessarily follow marching orders from Tehran.
Oh, I agree with that. They, you know, they don't necessarily love Iran, but they would much rather have friendly relations with their powerful neighbor than hostile relations.
But aren't you also saying that you would think that a sovereign democratic state in Iraq would mean essentially the United States would not have a client state? That's your argument, isn't it?
Well, the U.S. is desperately eager to make it a client state, but suppose they can't. Suppose it becomes sovereign and democratic, mildly democratic. Then it will, it's already doing it, but it will increase its linkages to Iran. Furthermore, there's another problem. Right across the border in Saudi Arabia, there's a majority Shiite population. They've been very harshly oppressed by the ruling tyranny that the U.S. supports. And as there are some moves towards sovereignty and independence in Shiite Iraq, they too are calling for rights, maybe for a degree of autonomy and so on. That happens to be where Saudi oil is concentrated. So I'm sure Washington planners are contemplating what could be an ultimate nightmare, a Shiite alliance, kind of a loose Shiite alliance, southern Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabian Shiite areas, independent of the United States, controlling most of the world's oil. I mean, that would be devastating for U.S. Plans going back 60 years, with the British almost 100 years. Furthermore, it can get worse. The U.S. can intimidate Europe. The U.S. shakes its fist and says, withdraw investments from Iran. Big European companies do it. The U.S. cannot intimidate China. It's one of the reasons they're so afraid of China. It's not that it's a military force. It just isn't intimidated. And they're increasing investments, trade, not only with Iran, but even with Saudi Arabia, the crown in the jewel in the crown for the United States. That could continue if there's be accelerated, even if there's an independent, sovereign, mildly democratic Iraq. Now, these are all things that the U.S. is going to try to stop by any means it can. Whether it can stop them, well, that's another question. But that must be a high priority. That's why the U.S. has been so strongly opposed to democracy in Iraq. Now, sure, they talk about it, but everyone talks about democracy everywhere.
Got a constitution.
Well, the U.S. tried to write the constitution. And when the Iraqis refused, the U.S. had to back off. The U.S. tried to eliminate elections with caucuses and all sorts of other devices, and the invading army was forced to back off, not by insurgents. They can deal with that. They were forced to back off by massive nonviolent resistance, huge demonstration. I mean, this is one of the real triumphs of nonviolent resistance.
I regret that we've come to the end of the hour, but as always, it's good to have you on, good to talk with you, and thank you so much for being with us, Noam Chomsky. Again, the author of the new book, Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy. For us, produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.